There's no single moment in which a regime obviously crosses a line into dictatorship. So write Harvard professors Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. For many, they say democracy's erosion is almost imperceptible. Not so for Levitsky and Ziblatt, who have studied the ways democracies around the world collapse, particularly in Latin America and the developing world, and now they've applied their toolkit to the United States itself in How Democracies Die, published by Penguin Random House. America fits a surprising number of their criteria for a country on the path to authoritarianism, reflecting a set of trends that long predate the Trump administration. Welcome to our discussions with two of six authors whose works are shortlisted for the 2019 Lionel Gelber Prize for Best Book in International Relations. The prize is presented annually by the Lionel Gelber Foundation in partnership with Foreign Policy Magazine and the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Toronto. These podcasts are sponsored by Focus Asset Management. I'm Rob Steiner, Director of the Fellowships in Global Journalism at the Monk School. Stephen Levitsky joins us from Boston, and Daniel Ziblatt joins us from Florida. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So I want to start with a question that my very politically engaged 18-year-old son asked when he saw the title of your book, and I've passed the book on for him to read, which is, if we're talking about how democracies die, is it possible to talk about an average lifespan for democracies?
Well, democracies, it turns out, are the opposite of human beings. As they get older, they get more robust. And in fact, at least if you base, if you generalize based on the history of the last century, the oldest democracies never die. We have very, very few cases of old democracies, democracies more than 50 years old that have broken down.
And so I'll ask, how do you gauge the health of America's democracy today, January 20th, 2019? It's 2 years since you started writing the book, a year since the book was out, 2 years since Trump became president.
Well, when we wrote the book, what really motivated us was seeing the behavior and rhetoric of Donald Trump on the campaign trail. He really was behaving a set of characteristics we identify in the book, violating a litmus test of who we developed to kind of identify authoritarian political leaders before they get to office. So attacking political opponents is not legitimate, going after the media, not accepting the rules of the game, condoning violence. This was kind of behavior we had seen elsewhere in the world. We had never seen in the United States. So that was very worrying. We continue to see that kind of behavior. But what's clearly happened over the last 2 years since Donald Trump has been in office is a lot of the worst damage one could imagine has been contained by the system of checks and balances. That said, you know, we're not certainly not in the clear, and I think there are a lot of really worrying signs. And both Steve and I make the case in the book that really what's driving these dynamics that we see today are underlying levels of polarization and also the complete abdication of the Republican Party. And these two things continue to really worry us. And so American democracy is really facing a series of tests that it hasn't faced, it certainly in our lifetime.
So actually, I want to break that down a little bit because, you know, even now, as Americans place a lot of faith in the Constitution and in the checks and balances and the guarantees that it gives outside of government structures like freedom of the press and so on, you're also in this book drawing our attention to a player that isn't even mentioned in the Constitution. And you're pointing out that democracy really depends on political parties. Why is that?
Daniel, why don't you take that one?
Well, political parties, you're right, aren't mentioned in the Constitution. They weren't really even invented when the U.S. Constitution was written and only emerged in the years after the U.S. Constitution was written, the first political parties in the United States. And so I guess there's two things that political parties really do that are absolutely critical that it's just impossible to imagine modern democracy without them. First of all, they help select candidates for office. And, you know, we sort of forget that before there's a general election, especially in a presidential system, there has to be this process where the candidates are selected, and parties have served as gatekeepers for our democracy. They've historically kept demagogic figures who might be threats to American democracy out of the competition, out of the running. And so throughout the 20th century, there have been demagogic figures. So Henry Ford, we talk about in the book, Charles Lindbergh was the famous pilot considered running for office. And throughout all of these instances, really what happens, political parties themselves, politicians select candidates. They, working in what was often criticized as smoke-filled back rooms, and parties served as great gatekeepers. the system began to change after the early 1970s when we introduced direct primaries and binding primaries. And so parties continue to be important, but their gatekeeping function has diminished. And so it's much easier now in our system for demagogic figure to get through. And that's what we saw in 2016.
You also make a very disturbing kind of observation when you talk about the polarization of American parties right now, and that's that U.S. politics is, you know, in the book, we're actually less polarized along party lines before Southern blacks were enfranchised in 1965. Before that, Republicans and Southern Democrats could actually find common ground on many issues other than segregation. After that, there was this huge realignment in the two parties, and the two parts have been moving apart ever since then. What would it take for America to depolarize itself now in a fully enfranchised system?
Well, that's a big challenge ahead of us. I mean, it shouldn't be that surprising, perhaps. I mean, as you know, in the United States, race has long been one of the greatest sources of division, one of the greatest sources of violence, and one of the greatest sources of democratic limitations throughout our history. And so it shouldn't be all that surprising that one way to depolarize or to limit conflict in the United States has historically been to exclude African Americans, to set the issue of racial equality aside. And that's what our parties did for most of our history. After the Civil War and after the intense polarization that followed Reconstruction, the two parties, with the Republican Party's decision eventually to abandon Reconstruction and to allow the Southern Democrats to reconsolidate power and to establish Jim Crow in the South, the two parties essentially agreed to set the issue of racial equality aside. And they did so for almost a century. They did so until the post-war civil rights movement. So what will it take to limit polarization in today's world, in the 21st century? I think ultimately it will take the Republican Party ceasing to be what is essentially a white Christian party. It is today. It's a party that represents what used to be not only a dominant electoral majority, but really the group that sat atop our political, social, cultural, and economic hierarchies. That's obviously a majority in decline in the United States. And a majority in decline often feels a pretty intense perception of threat. We think that perception of threat is what's driving Republican radicalism. What will it take to depolarize? It will take the Republican Party becoming a more diverse party, becoming a party that's able to compete and win votes among non-white and non-Christian voters. I think that'll eventually happen. But the path between here and there may be quite tumultuous.
In addition to parties, you also talk about another dimension of American democracy that sits way outside the Constitution, and you're urging us to pay attention to norms, the political practices that aren't in the Constitution. What norms are the most important for us to be paying attention to right now if we're gauging the health of American democracy?
Yeah, so we really zero in on two in particular. You know, there's a lot of talk about norms. Some norms matter. Some norms don't matter for democracy. We think two really do matter. These are kind of master norms that shape behavior in all sorts of aspects of political life, in Congress and the presidency and so on. The two norms are the first one we call mutual toleration, which is basically the idea of accepting your political rivals as rivals and as legitimate, who have a right to compete for office and to govern, and to not treat your enemies essentially as enemies, and to treat your enemies as threats in some way or to the national well-being. So this norm is absolutely critical. I mean, so rivals disagree over politics and policy, but if they accept each other as legitimate, a political system, a democratic political system, can endure. This norm is written down nowhere in law. It's just simply the way that politicians have often behaved and need to behave in order for democracy to be stable. The second norm is maybe a little less familiar, is the norm we call forbearance or institutional forbearance. Again, this is not written down anywhere, but this is a norm that's developed, an unwritten rule that's developed among political leaders and citizens as well. And the norm of forbearance essentially describes the self-restraint that politicians need in order for a political system to operate, and the self-restraint and the use of power. In And so under the law, lots of things are possible. Presidents can act as Supreme Court in the United States, expand the size of the Supreme Court whenever they like. Congress can block and the Senate can block using its right of advice and consent, can block every cabinet appointee or every appointee to the court if it wants. I mean, under the law, it's totally legal to do this. The reason this hasn't happened historically is that politicians recognize that in order for the political system to operate, it's critical to show some self-restraint, some underutilization of power. And these two norms of mutual toleration and forbearance are really what we call the soft guardrails of our democracy. Without these norms, just normal political competition degenerates into institutional warfare, either gridlock or complete abdication of the checks and balances. And so with these two norms in place, the system of checks and balances can work. And whenever our checks and balances have worked, these two norms have been in place.
So, Daniel, then a question to you, because I know you've also looked at British democracy, and we in Canada are in the same kind of constitutional constitutional monarchy as Britain. Do the same concerns apply to constitutional monarchies? Because a lot of the examples that you draw in your book are from democracies on the U.S. model, or former democracies on the U.S. model, the Philippines, not that it's former anymore, but the Philippines, Peru, Chile, Argentina, strong executive branch, separate legislative branch. But I'm wondering if the same would apply in a Canada, a Britain, and Australia, places that have a constitutional monarchy with a different kind of power structure.
Yeah, I think really the critical point, another way to make the point is that parliamentary democracies are different than presidential democracy. So systems where you have, as you say, the sharp divisions between the legislative branch and the executive branch particularly require forbearance because you can't, this kind of checks and balances and divided power, if one party's in control of one branch of government and the other party's in the other control of the other branch of government, and without forbearance, this quickly degenerates. A parliamentary system certainly is a little different, but it's also true that mutual toleration is absolutely critical in any kind of parliamentary democracy. Rivals need to treat each other as legitimate. And similarly, there are norms of self-restraint. I mean, particularly another example of a parliamentary democracy without a king, to be sure, but the German political system requires a set of parliamentary procedures as the British parliament does, where actors don't always push the limits and, for instance, ban another party from participating in debate, even if they have the legal right to do this. And so there's self-restraint necessary for all political systems and all democracies. But, you see this really clearly in presidential systems. And so it's a slightly different variant on the same theme, though.
So we're now, as we're having this conversation, and normally I don't sort of put a timestamp on these, but it's moving so quickly, and this discussion is so contextual, it merits noting that we're now just about 1 month into a government shutdown in the United States, and a whole bunch of things are falling out of that. You note in your book and in some of the writings that you've done in media over the last couple of weeks, that constitutional brinksmanship in a U.S. system creates a particular kind of danger to the health of democracy. Could you tell us what you mean by that and what you're seeing in the environment right now?
Again, I think this is a what you call constitutional brinksmanship is what Daniel just referred to as institutional warfare, particularly a U.S.-style system of presidentialism or checks and balances where you have various powers potentially controlled by different parties absolutely requires for its basic functioning a minimum of forbearance. If an opposition party decided to use its control over the legislature, for example, to prevent the executive from getting anything done, you fall very quickly into utter dysfunctionality or into a serious conflict between the executive and Congress. And that's exactly what we're seeing today, in large part because of intense polarization, because the parties are coming to see each other and see a victory by the other side as something that is utterly unacceptable, particularly for each party's base. Parties are unwilling to underutilize power, unwilling to not use their institutional power to the max, to exploit their institutional prerogatives to the max. And that leads to at best, gridlock, and at worst, the kind of borderline constitutional crisis that we're facing right now. Daniel and I met a couple of months ago with a group of U.S. senators, and one of the senators told us that in despair, that he thought that the days in which a president without a majority in the Senate where it was able to ever nominate a Supreme Court justice may be over. That never again, in the context that we're facing, would a president without a majority in the Senate be able to nominate a Supreme Court justice. That's a sign of serious dysfunctionality.
So we're now, and it's also a very kind of long-term perspective here. We're now counting down already towards the next presidential election. Are we entering sort of a lame duck period for Trump? Are we going to start to see, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel of these kinds of crises, or are we entering a particularly vulnerable moment 2 years into his administration?
Yeah, I think it's clear since the midterm election that Trump has certainly weakened. You know, there was a real risk, I think, before, a lot of people feared before the November election when the Republicans controlled all branches of government, that there was some kind of something approaching a kind of Hungarian model where one party controlled all branches of government and could do real kind of consolidation of power. That's certainly less risky now. And so that's a good thing, you know, so with the checks and balances in some sense have worked, our institutional channels have worked in creating divided government. What is worrying though is that this divided government, just as Steve was describing, we normally think means constraint. You know, checks and balances, the phrase itself suggests some kind of equilibrium where there's a kind of balance taking place and moderation at some level. But, you know, that again presumes that politicians will behave in the ways that they have behaved in the past. And I think what we've just seen, you know, just in the first week of a Democratic Congress being in office, you have a government shutdown. I think the risks of real excessive use of executive orders, which we haven't seen much of from President Trump because his party has controlled all branches of government, you know, which is something that all presidents have used. You know, President Obama used when facing a Republican opposition control of the other branches of government. I think we're going to certainly, and in the case of President Obama, there was a lot of reluctance to use it. There was a lot of thought and reflection in it. And nonetheless, this instrument of, you know, essentially adopting legislation through executive order was used. But I think under President Trump, this is much more likely. So I think, you know, the possibility of executive orders, of government shutdowns, of at this kind of escalation only heightened. I mean, what's really critical, though, to kind of keep our eye on is certainly his public opinion rating. I mean, you know, if his numbers decline, then the possibility that Republicans separate from him, you know, this may happen. If it doesn't happen and his numbers hold firm, I think, you know, there's going to be real escalation.
So, right. As things stand, I don't think we're facing any kind of a lame duck scenario because President Trump remains far and away the most popular Republican figure. And as long as that's the case, as Daniel pointed out, the Republicans in Congress are going to continue to back him. Only if and when his popularity falls considerably among Republicans, which could potentially happen, for example, with the Mueller report, although I don't think it's that likely. Until that happens, we face continued polarization and conflict, not a lame duck scenario. A lame duck scenario might allow Democrats and Republicans to come together and get something done at the margins of Trump, but we're not there yet.
So last question. We've spoken a lot about the Republican Party. What advice would you give to House Democrats about how to run the next couple of years?
Well, they've really faced a challenge and a lot of pressure to respond to a norm-breaking Republican Party, a norm-breaking president, tit for tat. So in other words, you know, if Republicans are going to fight dirty, then Democrats should too. And there's real pressure from the base for members of Congress to, you know, push for impeachment immediately. I mean, in fact, there was push for impeachment, you know, as soon as Trump took office from some quarters. And so, you know, what's really been impressive from my perspective, for a kind of perspective of sustaining democracy, is that the Democratic Party leadership has shown a great deal of restraint and has, you know, frequently repeated the line, you know, we need to wait for the Mueller report before we lead to any conclusions. And I think the Democrats need to continue to do that. And so we urge forbearance on the Democratic Party, because without forbearance, there's a real risk of a spiral where each side is escalating. You know, that said, you know, forbearance doesn't mean not doing anything. I mean, forbearance also means acting in ways that reinforce our norms and our institutions. So this can also mean a very aggressive reform agenda in which proposals are made to reform our institutions in ways that are compatible with democratic norms. So, you know, automatic voter registration, and other reforms like this, efforts to kind of make our politics more transparent. And so there's ways of carrying out reform, an aggressive reform agenda that reinforce rather than demolishing our democratic institutions. And so there's going to be great pressure, in fact, to kind of fight back just as the Republicans are doing. And so we really urge them not to.
Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt are authors of How Democracies Die, published by Penguin Random House. If you'd like to hear more Lionel Gelber podcasts, you can find all of them, all of this year's discussions and many from previous years on iTunes by searching for Lionel Gelber Prize, that's G-E-L-B-E-R Prize, or at our website, Monk School. Monk is spelled M-U-N-K, monkschool.utoronto.ca/Gelber. Thanks to the Lionel Gelber Foundation and Foreign Policy Magazine, and a special thanks to Focus Asset Management, funding media partner of these podcasts. I'm Rob Steiner, director of the Monk School's Fellowships in Global Journalism. I'm glad you joined us.